Mark Hunter, again from San Patricio, to join us this afternoon to speak on this topic, Thinking Twice and the Sermon on the Mount. Brother Mark will come up to give us his first class entitled A Tale of Two Mountains. Brother Mark.
Thank you. Honor, and thank you all for coming out. I'd like to start off by considering my clicker on another mountain where something tremendous happened and something tremendous began about 3,500 years ago. We have a prophet going up a mountain to gather and deliver a series of sort of concise instructions that lay the foundation of a religious movement that is still here today, 35 centuries later. We have, of course, the Ten Commandments. And there's a setting of the scene that occurs for us in the book of Exodus, chapter 19. And it says, "You shall set limits for the people all around, saying, take care not to go up into the mountain or touch the edge of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall be put to death. On the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast so that all the people in the camp trembled. And then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended on it in fire, and the smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly." So this is the scene, this is the stage that brings us this foundational piece of legislation that is still in many ways the foundation of modern legislation. And what did we see when we read Matthew chapter 5 and verse 1? Seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain. So we have our prophet going up on the mountain. And when he sat down, his disciples came to him. So even before we've gotten into the gist of the message that Jesus is going to present, he's already setting the stage for a different kind of relationship and a different kind of message than people have been used to throughout the years of Judaism. So think, whoever touches the mountain shall be put to death. That's where we started. And here we are, his disciples came to him. And so what does he begin? You know, here's this moment, he's gathered the crowds, they're all there waiting for this sort of challenge to the Mosaic law. And he begins with one word, blessed. And I'm sure that must have been a shock to the people who were listening. Blessed? You know, of all the words, of all the ways you could begin to show forth God's message to the people, blessed is the first word that he chooses. That's the first thing he wants you to think about. You know, people tend to remember the very first thing you say and the very last thing you say, and Jesus would have known that. So already he's like, if you don't get anything out of what I'm going to tell you today, other than this one word, this is the one that I want to stick with you. Blessed. And already I'm feeling personally challenged by Jesus' message, because when I speak to other people about what I believe, when I speak to them about the message of the Bible, and when I have just a moment to convey to them a little bit of my faith, Is that what I do? Is that where I start? Do I share with them what a tremendous privilege this is? Or do they maybe hear a little bit of that thunder and trembling and lightning? There are people in the world around us, and people from our community, actually, who struggle with this. I don't know if you guys know who this guy is. I heard it, somebody said it. Dawkins, okay? He's a militant atheist. He's out there with trying to destroy religion in all its forms. And he was recruited for this atheist slogan that they put on the buses in the UK. And it says, there's probably no God. And you notice they say probably. They can't even quite bring themselves to their slogans to say there's no God. I'm still going to put the probably in there. But anyway, there's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. So this is very insightful to us because it says the people who are out there watching religion have come away with what the essence of religion is based on our behavior and how we communicate. And what they've seen is worrying and not enjoying life. And they say, well, that's a travesty. We've got a philosophy that's better than that, right? Our atheistic philosophy, it doesn't really stop you worrying, but you know, the point is, they didn't get the point. Jesus started with that one word, blessed, and that very first word, we've already lost a good section of humanity. And within our community, that can happen as well. We lose people right on the first word, that they walk away because they feel that this is a burden, that this is something heavy for them to carry, and they've missed the point of the very first word, the very first principle, so to speak, that Jesus put us forward. Blessed. You know, in our community, we spend a lot of time talking about complex technical topics like the atonement, for instance. And how many times does the word atonement show up in the New Testament? Any takers? Depends on your version. Which version? One time in the King James. Guess how many times in the New King James, NASB, and the ESV combined?
Zero.
Right? And the airtime we give to a topic that occurs essentially zero times in the New Testament in terms of identified in that term versus the amount of time we spend talking about this topic might have something to do with why we sometimes end up with an unbalanced perspective. Now, if we need to find more encouraging verses, Romans chapter 8, there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. For the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has set you free from the law of sin and death. Do you feel set free from the law of sin and death? Is that what you show forth to others when you talk about your faith? That you are set free? In all these things, we overwhelmingly conquer through him who loved us. Do you feel like an overwhelming conqueror? Is that the aura that you carry with you? And I'll just read another passage that I just love and that I go to when I need a pick-me-up. Psalm chapter 8, verses 3 to 5. When I consider the heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou dost take thought of him, and the son of man that thou dost care for him? Yet thou hast made him a little lower than God, and dost crown him with glory and majesty. There's a tremendously huge universe out there, and of all the things that are going on in it, God has looked down and he's noticed you, and he's taken an interest in you, this little speck of dust in the flotsam of history, and he cares about you. And that, I think, is a tremendous blessing. Blessed are. Okay, second word of Jesus. Blessed are. What can we take from his second word? We're talking about right now. Like, it's not just that we're talking about great things that will happen someday, although there are those things as well, but in terms of how we carry our message, the blessing is now. This isn't a hypothetical. This isn't a wait and see. This is a blessing that occurs right now. Blessed are the poor. And here's where, again, each step of the way, Jesus kind of shifts the boat in a different direction. Blessed are the poor. That is not what I would have expected him to go with next, right? Blessed are the poor, because in our society, poor is not something that is normally associated with blessedness. And so already, he's trying to shift our thinking. The kind of blessing that he's talking about here is not determined by your circumstances, which is very interesting. When religion blesses us, it doesn't mean that you're never going to be poor. Because Jesus is saying, blessed are the poor. You can be poor and be blessed simultaneously. And the notion that blessing and comfort don't always go together is something that Moses brings up. We read about this in Hebrews, where Moses, if you recall, was born, well, was adopted into the household of Pharaoh. So he was raised as a prince. And it wasn't until he grew up, that he chose to go and suffer with the slaves, suffer with his people. And that's an interesting concept. And in a microcosm of this concept, in Canada Day weekend, we went up to Vernon and we spent some time with the Lawrences. And our little girl was up at 3 o'clock in the morning, puking all over the Lawrence household. And so I got up, and there's blankets and sleeping bags and all kinds of mess and disaster, and you're pulling it into someone else's bathroom and trying to figure out how to clean it up, and where do they keep buckets, and how they're going to keep, and you're sitting there, and it's 4 o'clock, and she's retching again, and you're sitting there uncomfortable and cold and feeling homesick with your little girl, and then the epiphany came to me that there is no other place I'd rather be. Right? Here's this little girl suffering, and if my discomfort can in some way make her feel more comfortable, I'm happy to be here far away from home cleaning up puke and holding buckets, right? It's a bizarre thing that the blessing came not from the circumstances in which I was, but in changing my point of view about those circumstances. And that is what's just remarkable about Jesus' word and the message he's bringing to us. Jesus' next words, in spirit. Blessed are the poor in spirit. And this is something else that Jesus constantly does. In the Luke account, he stops at poor, and I think it's because his audience was probably not as advanced. And in this case, he's saying poor in spirit. And again, Jesus elevates the game. I'm not talking about money, really. And money actually isn't the important kind of poverty in life. There is a poverty of spirit, which is actually what brings the blessing. Okay? We'll find this later on with blessed are those who hunger and thirst. In Luke, it's just blessed are those who hunger and thirst, and we're done. Here, it's blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. So he elevates our minds from the temporal material things into the spiritual realm. So, we had a different man on a different mountain, and he brings together a different list. And I want you to notice something about the first list. 8 times in the first list, what do we have? Prohibitions of some kind. 8 times we have prohibitions, and in the Beatitudes, 8 times we have blessings. And I think it's just a subtle way that Jesus is saying, you know what, we need to shift our thinking from a thinking of prohibitions to a thinking of blessings. So let's step back again and look at the whole phrase, blessed are the poor in spirit. Why would Jesus choose this attribute as the first attribute of the many that he's going to go into? And I propose to you, it's because poverty of spirit is what makes us moldable. If we are so full of ourselves, there's going to be no room for all the other pieces of information that Jesus wants to give us. They're not going to fit, right? If I know I've got it all figured out and I have no lack of my own spirit, then the rest of the message is pointless. The opening that Jesus needs is for us to be poor in spirit. Now, it's interesting, back to this command. Well, it's not even a command. Did you notice that? We have the Ten Commandments. These are the 8, we call them Beatitudes. But he doesn't say, be poor in spirit, or you must be poor in spirit. He just makes an observation about the way God sees the world. blessed are the poor in spirit, right? And he leaves it up to us to say, well, I want to be part of that blessing, and therefore I am going to seek out how to take on these character attributes, right? It's less about actions and more about character attributes. You know, when we look at the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill. Now, I can tell you for certainly today that I have not killed anybody today. Okay, so I can check that one off the list. But have I been poor in spirit today becomes a much more difficult question for me to answer. This theme that Jesus takes occurs in Luke as well. If you remember the first time Jesus stands up in the synagogue, he reads this passage from Isaiah. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news. Good news. This is the first thing that Jesus reads again when he gets up in the synagogue. He's been anointed to proclaim good news. Okay, to the poor, and you can keep it at the physical level and say, oh, it's about poor people, but let's see. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. He starts with the physical, but throughout his ministry, you see that he always elevates it to the spiritual. So the poverty that he addresses is a poverty of spirit. The captivity that he addresses is the captivity of law. It says in Galatians, before faith came, we were held captive under the law, in prison, until the coming of faith would be revealed. Jesus said, for judgment I came to this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. So yes, Jesus did heal some people's blindness, but that actually wasn't the blindness that he was worried about. Okay, that wasn't his ministry, was not to go and eradicate physical blindness. His ministry was to eradicate spiritual blindness. Blessed are those who mourn. I don't think he's talking about if your loved one has recently died, that you're somehow automatically blessed, right? He's elevating things to the spiritual. What kind of mourning is he referring to here that is a blessing to us? And I propose to you that the gospel is for people who love people. That's really the audience of the gospel, is people who love people. And if you love people, you want something better for them than what's happening all around you and in the world. And if you want something better for them and they're not able to attain it for all the various reasons that we have, then you feel sad inside. You feel a mourning for them. A mourning that comes out of love. And you say, well, that's uncomfortable. How is a blessing uncomfortable? But would you give up your love for someone in your life, in your family, just because you're sad about the circumstances they're in? No. You treasure it as a consequence of your love. We see an example where Jesus talks about Jerusalem this way. He says, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were unwilling. So I feel that in Jesus talking about Jerusalem. He was mourning. Why? Because he loved these people, and he just wanted to help them, and they didn't want his help, and that was hard for him. Blessed are the meek. Boom, another thinking twice. For they shall inherit the earth. How often in the regular world, do you see meek people inheriting the earth? You know, politicians of all stripes in every country are pretty much never meek, right? World leaders, sultans, kings, princes, they're never meek. And yet they're inheriting the earth. So this putting inheriting the earth next to meek is preposterous in a temporal sense. In the modern world, meekness will not get you the earth. But Jesus is saying there, it will, under God's rule. There's the earth, sorry. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. So here's another one that is good for some introspection. When you are torn away, taken away for some circumstance, away from God's word, away from God's people, what happens inside of you? You know, do you notice it? Because when you stop eating, and you don't have to actually do anything active, you can just not eat, and eventually something inside you starts gnawing at you, right? Starts sending a signal to you, you're missing something. Something is missing from your life. And if we can cultivate that in our spiritual life relating to the things of God, where if we happen to spend too much time away from the things of God, something starts gnawing inside of us and saying, you're missing something. You need something else. That is a blessing. You'll be familiar with Psalm 42, verse 1 and 2. As the deer pants for flowing streams, so pants my soul for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? This is David's sentiment, obviously. And then Isaiah, O everyone who thirsts, come to the waters, and you who have no money, come buy and eat. And this is where that poverty of spirit comes in. Do you understand that something is missing within you? That you want to go and fill it? You want to go find something to fill yourself with? How to reach out to people and convey that is a bit of a mystery to me. I don't know how to grow that in other people, but that might be something we can talk about later. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. This again seems counter to a religion of rules, because what does it mean to be merciful? It means somebody broke the rule and you're not going to hold them accountable for it. You go, wait a minute, you spend all this time setting up these rules and defining your institution according to these rules, and now we're going to say, it's really good if you don't enforce them. You know what? You know, there's something going on here. Blessed are the merciful. To have a system of values that we accept and that we don't diminish, but that we don't handle in a punitive fashion, is a very interesting and difficult thing to wrap our brains around. I did some scientific research of my levels of mercy on a scale of 0 to 10. Okay, where 10 is maximum mercifulness and 0 is no mercifulness. And I discovered in my analysis that the time lapse between my last public or substantial mistake and someone else's mistake has a direct correlation to the amount of mercy I'm willing to extend to them. So this happens with children. Like, if you knocked over the breakfast bowl and made a big mess, okay, and 1 hour later your child knocks over their breakfast bowl, I am full of patience and understanding. Oh, yeah, don't cry over spilt milk here, let's clean it up together, and so on and so forth. But as time passes, since the last time that I caught myself doing something, my levels of mercy seem to drop precipitously. And so if I haven't done anything clumsy in a while and a kid, you know, knocks over the nuts, like, what are you doing? You gotta be careful, you know, pay attention to what you're doing, and you know, clean that up yourself. And it's, but this I find applies in broader parts of life too. That if you've just made a huge mistake and everybody knows it, you're very cautious in applying judgment to other people. And the irony that we're going to get to in the next class is that the notion that it has only been 1 hour or 6 hours since our last big failure is entirely imaginary. We're steeped in our own constant failures, right? This is just a failure as I defined it to myself at that moment. But in terms of my actual character flaws, well, I've been carrying them with me all week. Right, but I'm not aware of them, and then, you know, the mercy level is level 3, because, you know, I've seen where someone else is. We've got to decide whether we see ourselves as rule defenders or character builders. Okay, what is our purpose here in this organization? Are we here to uphold a set of rules, or are we here to try to build people's character? The other side of being merciful is that it requires it to be more than a one-time event, right? In order for me to be merciful, somebody needs to have done something to me many times. And over the course of those many times, I am willing to let go of what justice might be due to me. And if we want an example, obviously, the fact that Jesus was able to forgive unrepentant murderers at the moment of his death really dwarfs any kind of hesitation that we might have to forgive other people. The Pharisees are there, they're essentially spitting at him and calling him names, and at that moment, Jesus is able to say, Father, what kind of man does that? Right? And it has to be a man who loves other people, and he loves them so much that even in the midst of their worst moments, he can see that they're just broken people, and my goodness, I wish we could unbreak them. I wish we could find something to fill them with. Blessed are the pure in heart. Now, I have another challenge with the pure in heart. Let me decide where my slide is. Oh, I have another scientific study. This is the purity of heart over the scope of my life. And the challenge here is at birth, I'm pretty sure I was 100% pure in heart. By age two, there had already been a bit of a decline. Anybody who's had a two-year-old will attest to that. Age five and age 10, and then the sort of 10 to 30 was not a good season for me. A lot of decline in purity of heart. And I think I've arrested the decline somewhat. But my challenge, and I don't have an answer for you, and we can maybe talk about it during the break or later, but how do you reverse this trend? How do you change this chart to go the other way? How do you create purity of heart when you feel you've already kind of gone down the roads of cynicism or whichever road that is, you know, eroding your heart? But anybody who's been able to maintain purity of heart, it is a remarkable characteristic. And I know a few people in my life that I've met who are not small children who are just the purest in heart people, and I just don't know how to get back to where they are. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. Abraham gives an example of this when he's fighting with Lot, and there's not enough water for their flocks, and he goes to Lot and he says, tell you what, let's split up, you take the best part and I'll take the rest. And valuing the relationship above the conflict is huge and tremendously difficult. But if we're going to have marriages that succeed, if we're going to have ecclesias that succeed and families that succeed, we have to cultivate the ability to let go of whatever it is and not necessarily, you know, come out at the better end of it. I don't think I have a word. Oh, so there's a dilemma in here, though, is that Jesus also says, do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. And this is where you have to start balancing the things that are said in here. What is a peacemaker? Is a peacemaker somebody who just rolls over whenever something that's in opposition to them shows up? Or, you know, where's the line between standing up for what God's principles are and being a peacemaker? If you see somebody doing something objectionable and wrong, should you just keep quiet because you don't want to cause any disruption? Peace does not mean lack of conflict. Peace means being in harmony with each other. You can have lack of conflict and not be in harmony with each other at all. And what Jesus is saying in this case is that, you know what, these teachings are going to create some conflict in your nations, in your families, in your own person, right? And that's good, because we're trying to bring you to a different way of thinking that is not natural to you, and not everybody's going to want to go down this path, and that process is going to create some conflict. But blessed are the peacemakers. And we can take that in two ways, in our interpersonal relationships, or also in the sense that we can bring people to God. And this comes back to filling that hole of the poor in spirit. The big conflict that exists throughout Scripture is between man and God. And to the degree that we can help people bridge that separation, we are peacemakers. And blessed are the persecuted, and this kind of almost goes without saying, but I'll read a section from Hebrews chapter 11. You'll all be familiar with it. Women received back their dead by resurrection. Others were tortured, not accepting their release, so that they might obtain a better resurrection. Others experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, chains, imprisonments. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were tempted. They were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, men of whom the world was not worthy. And I find that just fascinating. It lists all these terrible things that are happening, and then it stops and says, these are fantastic human beings, and the world is not worthy of them. And it just brings us right back to the start, that the concept of being blessed is not about being comfortable. It's about having a tremendous opportunity. And in the adversity that these people faced, they had a tremendous opportunity to show that there was something more to their lives than just their animal nature. And that is really the transformative mindset that I think the Beatitudes are meant to bring to us. We can be part of something that is fantastic, and it doesn't mean that everything in our life is going to be perfect each step of the way. It's our attitude, not our circumstances, that define whether we're blessed or not. Okay, so that's the Beatitudes section. The next, extra slide. Are we defining our religion as a religion of privilege or a religion of prohibition? This is coming back to the Ten Commandments versus the Eight Beatitudes, right? The Beatitudes start with the notion of privilege. What a privilege it is for you to be able to be a part of this. The Ten Commandments tend to be much more of don't touch this, don't do that. So, where does Jesus go next? He just went from getting away from the nitty-gritty of don't do this and do that, and he goes to the salt and light. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. And what does he mean by that? Well, what is it about salt and light that stands out? Well, if you add salt to a dish, you know it's there. And if you add light to a dark room, you know it's there. Right? And you don't have salt that is saltless. It wouldn't do you any good in your cooking. And if you had a light in a room and you covered it over with a bucket, you'd go, what's the point of having a light? The whole point of it being a light and the whole point of it being salt is that it has an effect on everything that surrounds it. And everybody notices that it's there. And that, I think, is he's saying, okay, we're doing away with the rules. Maybe not doing away, because that'll be his next verse, but we're de-emphasizing the rules, but we're not de-emphasizing that these things have a consequence in your life. When you are there, is it noticed? Is it different than it would have been otherwise? Because if you're like, yeah, I have this great light and nobody can see it, and I have this great saltiness but nobody can taste it, that is not the point that he was making with the Beatitudes. He is still expecting us to be people that have an impact on the world that surrounds us. So there's another, what I call the ninth Beatitude, another Beatitude that brings these two things together. And maybe I'll ask you to look up John chapter 13. It's a famous passage, but it combines these two concepts. And we'll read maybe starting in verse 3 to 5, and then we'll read 12 to 17. And you know, this is before the Last Supper, and at verse 3 it says, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come forth from God and was going back to God, rose from supper, laid aside his garments, and taking a towel, girded himself about. And then he poured water into the basin and began to wash the disciples' feet, and wiped them with the towel with which he was girded. And skip down to verse 12. And so when he had washed their feet and taken his garment and reclined at the table again, he said to them, do you know what I have done? done to you. You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, the Lord and the teacher, wash your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you should do as I did to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a slave is not greater than his master, neither is the one who is sent greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, you are blessed if you do them. And here's the crossover. You are blessed if you do. He's giving an example, and there's blessings associated with this example, but the blessings are actually conditional on changing your life, on acting differently than you would have acted otherwise. You know these things, you are blessed if you do them. Okay, so Jesus has spent all this time setting us up to kind of de-emphasize the Ten Commandments. And what does he do next? Do you think that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets? I have not come to abolish the law and the prophets. I've come to fulfill them. So again, change course on the ship, right? He spent all this time carefully at the mountain, and we're all like, okay, move away from the law. And he's like, well, wait a minute. We're actually not getting rid of the law in the way that you think we are. And what we have to understand is that the religion of the Beatitudes is not the grandfather God religion. Okay, sometimes you see it out there in Christmas or in kids' stories, but the notion of God as a benevolent grandfather, and it's not that he isn't benevolent, but the point is God still means business, I guess. It still matters. It's not that he doesn't care. It's not that he's not expecting anything from you. It's just a different way of looking at his religion. And if we look at Hebrews 12, this is the New Testament, right? This is talking about the New Covenant. See that you do not refuse him who is speaking. For if they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, and that's referring to Moses, the one who warned them on earth, and the people who rejected Moses, much less will we escape if we reject him who warns from heaven. So Jesus is coming along, and Jesus is greater than Moses, and the people who rejected Moses did not escape. There was a consequence to that rejection, and he's saying, so Jesus comes along, and he's greater than Moses. There's consequences for rejecting Jesus, too, right? We're not kind of just whitewashing everything away. Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, and thus let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. This is a New Testament passage. This isn't talking about the mountain that we were talking about in Exodus. Our God is a consuming fire. He still means business. And when we're talking about changing our approach to the law, that is not to say that Jesus doesn't mean business, that God doesn't mean business. These things are crucial, important, life-altering principles. And then, just as he brings the legalists back into the fold, so you can see the two camps there, right? There's the people who are in favor of law, and they were very uncomfortable at the start, and now Jesus has kind of swung the other way and said, well, hold on, the law is still absolutely important. I'm not replacing it. I'm just giving you a different perspective on it. Then he swings back the other way in a way that scares both sides, which is, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. And I think it's hard for us to really understand the impact of this statement on the audience of the day. But to them, it would have been, how on earth can I, as a baker, say, ever exceed the righteousness of a Pharisee who is basically a professional in the realm of religion? Right? I mean, he's done all the study and he dedicates all his life to the exacting execution of these principles. How on earth could I ever be better than them? You know, it's like if Jesus said, you've got to be a better hockey player than the Canucks. You know, apparently based on the last season, that's not such a hard professionals, and when us lay people are compared to them, we go, well, that's completely unattainable. So we're going to get into how this can actually happen in the next class, but keep in mind that at each step of the way, almost verse by verse, Jesus is tipping us away from our automatic way of thinking. There is a surprise in almost every verse in this section, a conclusion that we wouldn't think would follow from the premise, a way of thinking that is not the kind that we would come up with if we were setting up a religion. So where did we start? Well, we started, of course, in Mount Sinai, at the Ten Commandments. And maybe I'll get you to turn this up. Hebrews chapter 12 has a fascinating comparison between Mount Sinai and Mount Zion. And this, I think, is the essence of the comparison that Jesus is making in the Beatitudes. Hebrews chapter 12, and we'll start reading at verse 18. For you have not come to what may be touched, a blazing fire and darkness and gloom and a tempest and the sound of a trumpet and a voice whose words made the hearers beg that no further message be spoken to them, for they could not endure the order that was given. If even a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned. Indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I tremble with fear. So this is the stage that was set for the first covenant. And now we have a different stage set for us. But you have come to Mount Zion, and to the city of the living God, to the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks better word than the blood of Abel. And so the first question I'd like to leave you with today is, when you come to your faith and to your religion, which mountain are you coming to? When you get up on a Sunday morning, when you go and open up your Bible, is this the religion that you're thinking of? Is this the perspective that you have of God and His commandments and how they are involved in your life? Or are you coming to Mount Zion, to the righteous men made perfect? It's not the righteous people who are perfect, it's the righteous people who are made perfect. And when you speak to others of your faith, and when they see you carrying out your daily life, when they see you at meeting or in other events, what do they see? Is this what they see on your face? Or do they see this? And I propose to you that Jesus is calling you to a different mountain, and that the first principle that he wants you to understand about that mountain is that it's a mountain of blessing. And that his is a religion of blessing and a religion of doing.